Hello out there, my friends. This is Tim Binal of BinalofAmerica.com with another edition of Binal of America Audio. It is February 4th, 2006. This week we have Colm Kelleher, co-author of Hunt for the Skinwalker, one of the most talked-about books of the holiday season. Hunt for the Skinwalker tears the lid off the Nids Skinwalker Ranch in Utah and takes us inside what was going on at the Skinwalker Ranch all these years, and has some just amazing and chilling stories about some of the phenomena that were occurring at the Skinwalker Ranch while Nids was doing its research. A little bit about Colm Kelleher, for those of you unfamiliar with him. He is a senior research scientist with a 20-year career in cell and molecular biology. Following his PhD in biochemistry from the University of Dublin Trinity College in 1983, Dr. Kelleher worked at Canada's flagship Ontario Cancer Institute, the Terry Fox Laboratory at the British Columbia Cancer Research Center in Vancouver, and the National Jewish Center for Immunology and Respiratory Medicine in Denver. More recently, Dr. Kelleher served as research director for Bigelow Aerospace in Las Vegas and as administrator for one of its subsidiaries, Space Sciences, Inc. Dr. Kelleher also acted as team leader and project manager for the National Institute for Discovery Science, NIDS. Currently, Dr. Kelleher is the director of labs for a biotechnology firm in San Francisco. He has authored 38 peer-reviewed publications in molecular biology, immunology, biochemistry, and virology, as well as articles in popular magazines such as Omni. His websites are colmkelleher.com, that's colmkelleher.com, and huntfortheskinwalker.com is the website for the book. Let me spell that for you. It's HuntfortheSkinwalker.com, and that's the website where you can find more information about the book he co-authored with George Knapp called Hunt for the Skinwalker. And that's what we're here to discuss this week. During the course of the interview, Colm's dog was making some noise in the background, so eventually that stopped. But in case you hear some what sounds like a weird noise in the background, that's the dog. Don't worry, everything's cool. This interview was conducted on January 21st, 2006. Colm Kelleher on Binal of America Audio. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Binal of America Audio. My guest this week is Colm Kelleher. He's the co-author of Hunt for the Skinwalker about the Nids Ranch in Utah, and he was the project manager and team leader at a private research institute at National Institute of Discovery Sciences, which is NIDS. And he's also well-known in esoteric circles for his Mad Cow and CJD research and the book Brain Trust. And he has a PhD in biochemistry, and he is the guest this week on Binal of America Audio. Welcome to the show, Colm.
Great to be here, Tim.
Why don't you just give me a little brief bio on how you ended up at NIDS?
Well, my background, as you mentioned, is in biochemistry. I was working in a institute in immunology in Denver, Colorado in 1996 when I saw what I thought was a very interesting ad for research managers in a new institute that was published in Science magazine, which is one of the premier science journals. And the ad was specifically looking for people who were willing to research the origin and evolution of consciousness in the universe. Now, how often do you see an ad like that in science magazines? So obviously I was intrigued enough to answer the ad. At the same time, as an immunologist, I've always been interested in the effects on the immune system of altered states and different stress levels on the immune system, as well as physiology in general. So when I heard about this new organization called the National Institute for Discovery Science, obviously I applied, and I was successful. So I moved from Denver to Las Vegas in 1996 to begin working as a research manager at the National Institute for Discovery Science. And it was a very, very unusual organization in that it was specifically formed in order to study the quote-unquote paranormal or anomalies, which included UFO sightings, cattle mutilations, and you know, the usual cast of characters in paranormal phenomena. And what was different about NIDS was that it was fully funded by Robert Bigelow, who was the CEO of an aerospace company and also a real estate entrepreneur in Las Vegas. So he hired a bunch of professional scientists as well as a science advisory board, which had a lot of expertise in different topics, including physics, chemistry, biology. There were medical people on board. There was psychology people, computer science experts, and forensics. And all of these people were mainstream scientists who worked in government labs and academia. So National Institute for Discovery Science had both full-time scientists on its staff, as well as a very well-qualified science advisory board. So it was not the kind of usual investigation of paranormal phenomena that people talk about. In other words, people are doing it on their own time on weekends or you know, during the evenings kind of thing. So it, you know, from that perspective, I think the NIDF was a very unique organization.
Now, how long were you working for NIDS before they picked up the Gorman Ranch?
It was very quick, actually, because the Gorman Ranch began to sort of filter out into the media in summer of 96. I joined in August of 96, so there was a very short period between joining and actually getting involved on the ranch. My first trip to the ranch was in September 96, so it was very fast, actually.
Okay, and yeah, let me just do a little background here on the book, because the book is about the ranch, the infamous NIDS Ranch, that many in Esoterica have heard about and talked about for so long, and finally the book has come out. It's one of the most talked about books of the holiday season, and now everybody, I hope, has either picked it up and read it, or is going out and getting it after this interview, or they're going to shut off the interview and buy it and read it and then listen to the interview. But it's definitely, you got to check out this book. It was awesome. I loved it. And it's about this ranch. First, this family moves there. All kinds of crazy stuff happens. Giant wolves, UFOs, Bigfoot-type sighting things, just poltergeist-type activity, crazy stuff. They eventually can't take it anymore. They move out. The NIDS, the National Institute for Discovery Science, buys the ranch, and they install these fine folks, these scientists, of whom Colm was one of. Is that pretty much the gist of the story?
Yeah, that's correct. The family, I think, were at the stage of mental and physical exhaustion by summer of 1996. And so they started reaching out for help, and word got out into the media, and we heard about it in July or so of 1996. Now, at this stage, the family had been on the property for about 20 months, which is a very short time, but during that period, out of a herd of 80 cattle, which was their livelihood, they bred high-end cattle, like Black Simmentals, Black Angus. Out of a herd of 80 cattle, they had either lost, disappeared, or had been killed, 14 animals. So a normal attrition rate for this kind of an operation was one animal per year. But 14 animals had disappeared or been killed in 20 months, and they were essentially economically bankrupt. At the same time, they had been exposed to almost daily or weekly extremely stressful events that they could not explain. This was a salt of the earth family who were basically looking to set up a ranching operation in a quiet area of northeastern Utah, and they just wanted to get about their business, but they were constantly besieged by phenomena they could not explain, to the extent that they lost sleep. The kids in school, their grades fell from straight A students all the way down to D's, and they just couldn't sleep. So by the time we actually took over the property, they were all sleeping in the same living room in this small property, on the floor, just for protection, basically, in numbers. They were so traumatized by what had happened. They hadn't had a decent night's sleep in a couple of months. So they were ready to get the hell out of there as quickly as possible. And when NIDS saw the potential, we instantly purchased the ranch and set it up as an experimental laboratory in the paranormal.
Now, in the story, you guys are investigating stuff, and often you say it wasn't enough to bring to the science board. Do you follow me? Like the Now, what? Like, explain to me this sort of how that was set up. Like, were they kept sort of out of the loop, but they didn't go there and check it out too? It's sort of like you would bring what you guys found to them, and then they could, but it wasn't ever enough.
Well, the science advisory board, some of the members actually visited the property on a number of occasions. But there were 15 to 16 people on the board. They were all working in different parts of the country. They were extremely busy in their mainstream jobs. They worked in either research laboratories, universities, or government laboratories. So they had, you know, very busy day jobs. So every couple of months, they would be flown to Las Vegas for a series of briefings.
Oh, wow.
From the NIDS staff who would spend all the time on the property. We would compile all of the data that we had come up with, including any photographs, any tracings, magnetic field tracings, any videotape, and we would essentially go into these exhaustive briefings over a several day period. And the Science Advisory Board were looking for evidence that was deemed acceptable in mainstream science, and you know they were pretty strict about adhering to scientific protocols. So all of the evidence that was collected, certainly in the initial stages, were basically eyewitness testimony from NIDS researchers who were on the property. They saw weird stuff. A lot of the stuff that we saw was very transient. It was difficult to capture on film because it was there one moment and then it was gone the next.
Yeah.
It rarely reappeared in exactly the same spot. So, you know, setting up cameras, which we did in a particular area, sometimes didn't yield the kind of result that the Science Advisory Board was looking for. But in general, they were extremely supportive. I mean, some of them actually became mentors to the project, and they were in touch by either telephone or by email practically every week. So it was not sort of like this group of scientists who were sort of removed from the whole project. They were extremely well aware of what was going on a weekly basis, but they were flown to Las Vegas every couple of months and given these extended briefings that lasted over a few days.
And now you know about how the paranormal, so there's a stigma attached to it, to studying it. Were the scientists on the science board and you guys at the ranch and stuff, was it sort of kept on the down low with these guys so it wouldn't hurt their reputation, or was it pretty well known that they were part of the NIDS board?
Some of them did agree to release their names publicly and their association with NIDS, but quite a few of them refused because for exactly the reasons you've given. And to this day, there are several members of the NIDS Science Advisory Board whose names have never been made public, and that is because some of them were extremely well known in their own fields of science, and their reputations would be tainted by association with this kind of a study. No matter how rigorous and no matter how scientific this study was, the fact is that it is considered totally off limits by mainstream science. It is considered flaky. It is damaging to one's career. You can lose research grants. You can lose your reputation. And once your reputation has gone in science, obviously everything else starts going down the toilet.
Yeah, exactly. Now, maybe you can answer this question for me. It was kind of like, I'm just a suburban guy. I didn't understand this. The Gormans lost a lot of cattle. Then they moved, but there was still cattle at the NIDS ranch. Did they not move the cattle, or how did that work out? Or was this NIDS provided cattle?
Well, the NIDS organization actually purchased a lot of the cattle from the Gormans in order to set up exactly the same conditions on the property as had been experienced in the 20 months before we bought it. So the organization actually owned the cattle. They had been sold by the Gormans to NIDS, and so we installed them essentially to keep the environment in as close approximation as previously. So when the Gormans moved off, they had other they moved to about 25 miles away from the property. Tom Gorman, the family guy, was kept on at NIDS as a ranch manager for a few years because he was absolutely outraged at having been thrown off his property by something he had no idea of what was constituting the force that forced him to move off. So he was determined to find out as much as possible. He was looking to NIDS to see if he could find some answers.
Yeah.
So he joined the NIDS organization as a ranch manager on the property. So he became a ranch manager on the very same property that he had owned in the previous 20 months. And he did it purely to find out some more answers. And you know, this guy was the salt of the earth. He was not sort of given to delusions or sort of fantasies. He was extremely interested in whatever had killed his cattle, because, you know, it was a violation of his own privacy. It was a violation of his property rights, and he had no idea of who or what was doing this to him or had done it to him. So he stayed on. The rest of the family moved off to about 25 miles distance. Then a few years later, they moved out of state, and they've been trying to put this whole episode behind them. They don't want to be talked about, or they don't want to be contacted.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when you guys first got to the ranch, he suggested a less is more type attitude in studying. Do you think you guys went along with that, or do you think you didn't go along with it enough, or what did you think of that sort of perspective on doing the study of the ranch?
Well, we moved onto the property as quickly as possible. We installed a command and control center on the property right beside where the rancher had been living for the previous 20 months. We brought in a lot of equipment, including recording equipment, and we installed people 724 on the property. The Gormans, especially Tom Gorman, was advising us to, and in hindsight, it may have been wise to take his advice, but we were intent on tracking whatever this thing as quickly as possible. So his advice was take it softly, softly, set up a command and control center, you know, 10 miles away, be on the property as if you were hunting an extremely skittish wild animal, was the advice he gave us.
Yeah.
We decided in the interests of time and the interests of getting data as quickly as possible to move quicker than Tom Gorman was advising. But, you know, as it turned out, there was still plenty of activity on the property.
Yeah.
When we moved on, it was not like everything shut down. But there was a difference in flavor to the events that happened once we moved on and, you know, the Gormans had moved out.
Now, did you ever live, like, on the ranch? I know you guys, sometimes they would spend time there. Did you actually spend time there and live there? Or earlier in the book, you referenced being flown from Vegas to the ranch when that first calf gets
Yeah, well, beginning in 1996, in September of 1996, we would be on the ranch. We would live on the ranch for 5-7 days. And then we would come back to Vegas for a couple of days. Then we would go back to the ranch for 5-7 days. So we were living most of the time on the ranch for the first year and a half, with the exception being once the temperature plunged down below zero up in northeastern Utah.
Oh, yeah.
We came back to Vegas. We were in constant daily conversations with Tom Gorman. And he would report anything unusual. We would make the decision to fly up there or not. We did have a private jet at our disposal, which is an unusual facility for a research team. And, you know, as you mentioned, in March of 1997, we were actually on the point of going up there anyway when we got the call that an 84-pound calf had been dismembered in broad daylight on the property. So we got on the private jet. We moved up to Utah. We were standing over the animal within literally 4 to 5 hours of the phone call, and the animal was lying on the grass with its all four legs spread eagled on the grass. All of the internal organs were gone. The ribs had been cut open, and everything was with the entire body cavity was empty. There was not a drop of blood on the animal or underneath the animal, and this had all happened a few hours previously when Tom Gorman and his wife were tagging these newly born calves. They had just tagged this particular animal, moved down the property about 300 yards to tag another animal, when they noticed the dog that was with them began behaving kind of strangely.
Yeah.
So they went back to investigate the source of the dog's discomfort, and they found this calf they had just tagged 45 minutes earlier. And remember, this is like 11 o'clock in the morning. This was a bright, sunny day. Everything looked peaceful except for the fact that this calf that they had tagged previously had been completely dismembered in broad daylight with no sound. These two people were only 300 yards away. Both had excellent hearing. Both had excellent eyesight. They didn't see or hear a thing. So we had a veterinarian as part of the research team who instantly started conducting a necropsy on the dead calf. First thing he noticed was that the ear, which had carried this new ear tag, had been sliced off to the skull, and his initial impressions was a sharp instrument had been used. But he took samples anyway. He sent those samples to three different independent veterinary pathology labs who confirmed his initial observation that sharp instruments had been used on this ear. There was also one of the femur bones had been forcibly ripped out of the animal and was lying on the grass about 10 feet away from the animal when we discovered it. We packaged this bone off, sent it to one of the top forensic laboratories in the country, who came back then later saying that two separate different sharp instruments had been used on this bone, one a heavy machete instrument and the other like a light, like tweezers, scissors kind of instrument. So there was strong evidence that this animal certainly had been killed in association with sharp instruments. The cause of death was not immediately known, except the animal had been totally dismembered. And the fact that there was not a single drop of blood on the animal or underneath the animal was really spooky to look at, because this animal should have had between 2 and 3 liters of blood.
Oh, yeah.
If you slash an animal's throat, you know, there's blood everywhere, you know, when you're killing them. And to have this done completely silently in the presence of a couple of very alert people 300 yards away is even more spooky. So we got the services of a professional tracker on the spot to start looking for tracks. He spent the next several days quartering the property within a quarter to half a mile radius of this dead animal, and found pretty well no tracks, no evidence whatsoever. And this guy makes a living from tracking, so it's not like this was the first time he was doing this, and there was no tracks whatsoever. So whatever happened in terms of this 84-pound calf was a pretty unique method of killing. It showed signs of tremendous force. In other words, it does take a lot of force to rip the femur away from the ball and socket joint, tear all the ligaments from the femur of even a newborn calf, and lay it on the grass. And the way the animal had been laid on the grass also was very unusual. It was obviously placed there, carefully placed there. It was not thrown there in a heap of bones and flesh. It was carefully placed there with all four legs spreading to, you know, different points of the compass. It was obviously very carefully done, whatever that operation or whoever did that operation. So the forensic analysis definitely tied it to sharp instruments. So this was not a predator attack. It was a very skillful operation carried out by people who were fairly well acquainted with surgery.
Now, one thing that stood out for me when I was reading the book was sort of on the theme of digging, because when the Gormans first bought the ranch and the property in the sale, it was that they couldn't dig without prior permission or something like that.
Yeah.
And then later you say you guys consulted some remote viewers and they said there was something under the ground. And then later you said you guys dug into the ground at some point, and it seemed to cause some UFOs to come around. How extensive did you guys investigate that aspect of the ranch?
Well, we actually imported a big caterpillar digger up onto the property.
Yeah.
And we used that to periodically dig these large trenches on the property, because the Gorman family had told us a series of anecdotes when they started changing the overall topography, that they found that it seemed to be a signal for an increase in intensity of this activity. So we decided to see if we could stimulate the activity,
because
it was very, very difficult to capture anything on the fly, so to speak, because we never knew when or where anything would erupt or what kind of incidents would happen. So we decided to try to be more proactive. So we started digging on the property, large 50-yard-long trenches, this kind of thing, alter the topography. And in several cases, within, say, 72, 96 hours, neighbors would begin reporting increases in activity. We never actually captured the activity, the so-called quote-unquote response to digging on the property, but we did find that it did seem to elicit some kind of a reaction, albeit a delayed reaction. But we were never able to capture the evidence of that reaction on the, you know, in a way that the Science Advisory Board found acceptable.
Yeah. Now, during all this time, you guys were at the ranch because of the original publicity for the Gormans. It became quite a hotbed of rumors in the esoteric world. What did you think about that at the time? And were you hearing from people in, you know, ufology and cryptozoology and various fields trying to get information on what was going on there?
Yeah, we were getting, I'd say, weekly to monthly communications from all of the above, people who wanted to get on the property, people who had heard about what the Gorman family had been through. They had heard about NIDS purchasing the property because that made the media also. Yeah. There was a couple of newspaper stories about it. So it became notorious very quickly, and we decided to try to professionalize this investigation by basically clamping down on publicity and try to set this area up as a laboratory of the paranormal,
yeah.
Install equipment, install personnel, and do scientific research without being disturbed by you know, people who are trying to encroach on the property, people who are trying to get on the property for whatever reason. So the idea was that if and when anything materialized in terms of scientific validity from this investigation on the property, then we'd be in a position to publish it, we'd be in a position to talk about it. But before that, we had no intention of publicizing what we were doing,
yeah.
And that's, in our view, still a legitimate way to conduct science. Science by press conference is always a bad idea, and this, of course, led to a whole slew of rumors in the esoteric fields that, you know, we were covering up evidence, that we were in contact with aliens, that we were, you know, trying to, you know, invite the CIA onto the property, this kind of thing. So there was multiple different conspiracy scenarios spun out of the fact that we were not willing to go on the record about the kind of research we were doing. And the reason we weren't willing to go on the record was because we were trying to conduct a legitimate scientific investigation, and the idea is to gather the data before you actually start talking about it.
Yeah. Yes. Did you have a lot of incidents where people trying to break into the ranch, or was it pretty, like, after a while, like, people knew not to bother with, like, Area 51 type situations?
Well, we had constant surveillance of the property perimeters, and actually that surveillance continues to this day. So it was always monitored. There were people always there. And there still are. So, I mean, it was difficult for people to encroach on the property, even though some people did try.
Yeah.
It became pretty obvious during the tenure of NIDS on the property that there were, you know, police would be called, and any trespassers would be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. So there was an active discouragement of people getting on the property, and it was pretty successful. We, after the first spate of media publicity died down, there were very few incursions.
That's good. Now, I know NIDS sort of has stepped down on the ranch investigation, but you guys did the Black Triangle UFO study, and you did sort of like a sister investigation in Dulce. What other sort of studies have you guys done that you can talk about or anything like that?
We've looked in several different areas around the country, primarily, as you mentioned, Dulce, New Mexico, and also northeastern Utah. But we've done a fair number of studies down around in the Buckeye area in Arizona,
yeah.
Where there's been a lot of reported sightings, where the famous Phoenix Triangle was associated with that area, and we've gone to targeted areas in California on occasion to investigate alleged incursions, and also we've actually gone out east on the odd occasion too. But primarily, our focus has been in the southwest of the country.
Yeah. And what made you
we have investigated. We actually sent people out to Illinois during the famous January 2000 Black Triangle incident
that
flew over Scott Air Force Base. So NIDS was pretty active around the country in investigating targeted sightings that were considered, considered worthy of investigation. But in general, the vast majority of the time, especially during the years 1996 through 2000, were spent either in northern New Mexico or in northeastern Utah.